The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I learned far more than I expected. I knew counterterrorism policing very well. I thought I knew MI5 well because, you know, every couple of months I'd been invited to the wood-paneled office of the Director General and I'd met other senior people and they had talked me through how things were going. The reality was I didn't know them at all. And I don't think you do know an organization until you've stood in the elevator, until you've sat in the canteen and listen to what people are saying, till you've been to meetings where sometimes quite junior people are saying things the way they see them. It is a very impressive organization, and it works very well with the police. Those things are not in doubt. But if you ask me to sum up in one word how I find MI5, I think I'd use the word young.
I'm Shannon Tagawa Mercer, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 13th, 2018. This week, Benjamin Wittes and I are very pleased to be interviewing a special guest from across the pond, Mr. David Anderson, QC. In addition to his extensive career in human rights litigation and EU law, David Anderson, senior barrister, has been integral to the development and assessment of UK counterterrorism and intelligence policy in roles that really have no analog here in the US. Last year, he released a one-of-a-kind report detailing his independent assurance of the handling of intelligence after the tragic set of terrorist attacks in the UK in 2017. We brought him on the podcast to discuss this new role, as well as his prior experience and his perspective on where counterterrorism and intelligence policy is heading. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 276, David Anderson on the United Kingdom's intelligence policies. Good morning, David. Thank you for joining us on the Lawfare Podcast.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
Great. So I want to jump right into this conversation. You've held two very unique positions, both sort of in the UK government and as an independent assessor. And so I thought that it would be interesting for our audience if you could walk us through both of those positions. So first, your role as the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation between 2011 and early 2017 doesn't exactly have an analog in the U.S. government, or maybe other governments. Would you mind sort of describing what the mandate of that position was?
It combines two characteristics, both of which are common, but which are extremely rare in combination. And the first of those is complete independence. I was basically an attorney picked off the street to do the job. The second is full security classification, so that you can read all the secrets, you can talk to all the secret people. And the deal is that our parliament is frequently called upon to pass legislation to fight terrorism. Most of them are not security cleared. They say, well, within reason, we will go along with what you want us to do, but only if you give us access to a security cleared independent person we can trust, who tells us how these laws are being applied, and therefore whether we should vote to renew them or to prolong them, or indeed whether we have to conclude that they're not necessary. So that's the deal. It goes right back to the 1970s, when terrorism in this country really meant Northern Ireland, as in fact to some extent it still does. It's useful, particularly to people on the civil liberties side who have a way of feeding in, getting me to look at things that they can't see and reporting on them. It can also, of course, be useful to government to the extent that I give them a clean bill of health and say, you know what, this power might look a very strong one, but it's extremely useful. So it's survived for 40 years. It's a central part of our counterterrorism landscape.
So, David, just to flesh out the scope of the role, my impression was that while the role had been there for 40 years, it augmented significantly over the years post 9/11, and specifically in the years that you had it, and they kept sort of dumping more stuff in your lap. Is that right? And if so, how did the scope of the role grow?
Well, the role, as it is written in statute, is to review the operations of the counterterrorism law, mainly by police, by prosecutors, by government ministers who have some pretty substantial discretions in this country where counterterrorism is concerned, including in the field of immigration. As time went on, particularly after Snowden, which was a bit of a watershed in the UK as it was everywhere else, the focus shifted more to the intelligence agencies, to surveillance. And the surveillance we had in place at that time, the oversight we had in place at that time of intelligence agency activity was relatively light compared with how it is now. So I suppose because my work had made me perhaps a recognizable figure to people who were interested in counterterrorism and security, I was asked to do a very high-profile review of our entire law on investigatory powers, which ended up in a big new act of parliament in 2016, which really remade the whole landscape there. And as the bill was going through parliament, I was asked to do a very specific report, again with a small expert team, on what we call the bulk powers, what some people call mass surveillance. I don't particularly like that term, but powers which are as controversial here as they are in the US. I was asked to do a classified report and also a report in an open version on the effectiveness of those powers. So, yes, I was taken off piste in my last couple of years in the job, and I found myself quite close to the center of the political debate, although, of course, I was trying to inform that debate in a neutral way. I took my inspiration from reports I'd seen by the National Academy of Sciences in the US, and actually by your PCLOB, which, as you know, did a couple of very useful reports on surveillance-related issues.
So I've read sort of assessments of your period as the independent reviewer, and it seems as if there was sort of broad positive reception for your recommendations. But how did you find the interaction with as an independent assessor of the laws? How did the government receive your recommendations? Were there particular moments of friction or difficulty?
I found I was walking a real tightrope, because if people get the feeling you are too favourable to the government, then of course they lose faith in you as an independent monitor. Equally, had I been too strident a critic on everything the government did, I think they would pretty soon have found ways to stop showing me secret things that I really needed to see. So that was tough. I took the view that I would simply call it as I saw it, and I didn't only make recommendations that I thought would be accepted, and quite a few of my recommendations were not accepted. For example, I thought the definition of terrorism in this country was much too broad. It's based on an old late 20th century CIA operational definition, which somehow found its way into our law. There was some minimal amendment as a consequence of my recommendations. But what I found was, even in a case where government did not accept my recommendation directly, if I could get the media interested in it, then that would get Parliament interested in it. We are very, as in the US, very powerful legislative committees that would call me to give evidence and would make their own recommendations, which could be quite influential. Or the courts would be interested. I mean, I tended to find that lawyers on both sides of national security cases, hopefully, would rely on my reports, on the findings in my reports. And sometimes those findings were echoed by judges when they related to matters of law or indeed to the assessment of evidence. So I found that there are in a complex democracy, there are many routes to influence. And simply having the government say what a good idea, let's do it, is only one of those routes. I found if I could work with Parliament, with the courts, then they were force multipliers, if you like. I mean, they made my made my recommendations more influential, more likely to be accepted.
So over the course of your tenure, there were significant changes. You've alluded to a few of them a few minutes ago. And you wrote a report recently called Shades of Independent Review. And it seems like you paint this very broad picture of a few inflection points. And I wonder if outside of the Snowden document releases, there are other notable inflection points that really changed your role or relationship with your position.
Well, the biggest, of course, was 9/11, which was before my time. But my predecessor was actually appointed to the job in the English morning of 9/11. So before breakfast in New York, he was called by the Home Secretary and said, look, do you want to review our terrorism laws? It's a fairly sleepy area these days. Not much going on in Northern Ireland anymore, but we'd appreciate it if you would keep an eye on them. So he said, sure, I'll do that. 6 hours later, he called her back and said, you know, you've seen what's just happened in New York. Are you sure you still want me to do this job? So that was really what transformed the job.
That's even worse than Bob Mueller. He at least had a week.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it helped also that my predecessor, you know, like me, he's a senior attorney, but he had been an elected member of parliament. He was by then a member of the House of Lords. So he was a public figure who was very used to being a public voice. And he therefore made the job not so much just a lawyer looking at the papers and writing opinions that not many people read. You know, he really put the job in the center of the public debate, and I inherited that status, if you like, and was able to carry it on. So that was the main thing. But I think, yes, I mean, my period of office, 2012 to 2017, there were barely any successful terrorist attacks in the UK. The only ones that there were killed one person each, and actually two of those were from the far right. And only one, though it was a particularly unpleasant one, the killing of a soldier, Lee Rigby, off duty in London, was by an Islamist. So from that point of view, it was fairly quiet. I would say it was, first of all, when Snowden was stopped at Heathrow, Miranda, Glenn Greenwald's partner, was stopped at Heathrow Airport with an awful lot of stolen and secret documents. And there was a huge furore about the powers that were used. That was probably the first major event back in 2013. And then, of course, the series of attacks we had last year, actually just after I'd stepped down from the job. But I was asked to do some work in relation to those as well.
So is it fair to say, I mean, as I recall your predecessor's work, it was largely on my radar screen at the time, not for reasons of surveillance, but for reasons related to detention authorities that the government was asserting and using with respect to people it was wanted to deport but couldn't manage to get rid of, as well as the control orders that followed that. Whereas your tenure was much more focused on detention on surveillance matters because of Snowden. Is that a fair characterization of sort of the shift in emphasis of the office or the shift in emphasis of the issues? Or were you actually doing a lot of control order monitoring too, and he was doing a lot of surveillance stuff too that we just didn't notice?
The job is about, as you say, detention periods, stop and frisk, control order monitoring, routine police prosecutorial activity, and we both did that throughout our periods in office. But as is the way of things, if you've been around a bit, people get to know you and they think of you when they want to do something extra. So for me, the surveillance work was something not written in statute that I was invited to do by the Prime Minister and that I did in addition to my normal duties.
So then moving on to the second role that you played, which is also very unique, when the Home Secretary wrote you this letter asking you to conduct or provide independent assurance of the internal review that the police and MI5 initiated in response to the attacks after your tenure as the independent reviewer, what were you thinking about when you were thinking about whether to take on this role? It seems like it has a slightly different mandate and a slightly different position relative to the government.
Well, when I was asked to do it, it felt like a patriotic duty. I didn't feel I really had much choice but to accept it. But I was concerned about accepting it because the deal this time was not that I would come in with a team I'd chosen myself and do my own fully independent review. The idea was that in an attempt to learn very quickly the most important lessons from 4 successful attacks in the early part of 2017, there should be an internal review actually led by MI5, the Internal Security Service, and by counterterrorism policing, into which I should be embedded in order to assure the quality of the review and to assess it. Now, the risk to my reputation, of course, was that I was becoming associated with a report that I wasn't driving and on which I wasn't ultimately calling the shots. And the concern was that I would somehow, a bit like these journalists who were embedded in the front line in Iraq years ago, you know, the risk is that you become too closely associated with the people you're supposed to be assessing. But I still felt it was worthwhile because it was a very unusual opportunity to get right inside, right under the skin of these organizations. And because my involvement there was very public, I think they all knew that I had the ability to go back to Parliament or to go back to the press and say, you know, they're not very serious about this. They're not facing up to what went wrong. They're hiding things. They're not showing me things. And that gave me a sort of leverage which wasn't written down anywhere, but I think was in practice pretty substantial.
And to take it a step back, could you describe for us exactly what the report ended up being? So what was the scope of the report and what did you end up taking away from your experience while embedded?
Well, it was really intensive work over a period of 4 months by large teams from MI5 and counterterrorism policing. And all this performed at a time of absolutely heightened threat. And the threat basically shot up on the 1st of January 2017 and has not diminished since. They produced their own internal reports of about 1,150 pages in total, which were all about, first of all, how they handled the intelligence they had on the perpetrators of these four attacks. And in three cases, they had quite a bit of intelligence. And then also an operational improvement review in which they sought to draw lessons from what they'd observed. Now, my role in all this was to be, as I put it, a gadfly, you know, on the hide of the beast. I couldn't lead them around, but I could sting them pretty hard and make them jump. So I went to internal meetings. I found if I stayed quiet long enough, they just forgot I was there. That was extremely revealing. Meetings where you had young desk officers, analysts, going painstakingly through every decision point, working out were they right, were they wrong. And I also sat in the meetings of the operational improvement review, sometimes critiquing their suggestions, sometimes saying you're avoiding the issue here, sometimes saying you've asked the wrong question, and sometimes saying, aren't you ignoring something rather big? So I was there really to make myself difficult to try and guard against complacency on their part and to try and encourage them in some respects to be radical, certainly to be aware of what the outside world would be likely to think about the way things were going. So I was there really as a catalyst, if you like. I was there from the beginning of the process and I was commenting, in total probably many hundreds of times. And at the end of the day, when they produced their reports, I was able to give those reports a pretty unqualified welcome and say that I thought they'd done a good and thorough job.
And are you, having done this, I mean, this is an experience that I would kill to have with the U.S. intelligence community. Having done it, are you, did you emerge more, less, or about as impressed with the professionalism and legal compliance of the people and organizations in question than you expected to?
I learned far more than I expected. I knew counterterrorism policing very well. I thought I knew MI5 well because, every couple of months I'd been invited to the wood-paneled office of the Director General and I'd met other senior people and they had talked me through how things were going. The reality was I didn't know them at all. And I don't think you do know an organization until you stood in the elevator, until you've sat in the canteen and listened to what people are saying, till you've been to meetings where sometimes quite junior people are saying things the way they see them. It is a very impressive organization and it works very well with the police. Those things are not in doubt. But if you ask me to sum up in one word how I find MI5, I think I'd use the word young. Now, this may be my own advancing years, or it may be the fact that numbers are expanding very quickly. There was a 30% uplift in the intelligence budget in 2015, and that is only now feeding through into a pretty rapid increase in personnel. But it made me realize that when it comes to not only assessing the threat, but working out how to respond to it in individual cases, you really need a mix of expertise. There are brilliant young people working as analysts in MI5. They've left university. Since then, they've sat behind a computer screen, and they're very, very good at what they do. But if they're dealing with a part of South Manchester where the terrorism is all mixed up with drugs and crime, they need somebody there who's policed that area, you know, someone who's been to court and seen his case collapse because the evidence wasn't believed. And I think that the policing perspective is really important. And one of the big lessons that came out of these reviews, yes, they work well together already, but they have to do more, in a sense, to pool their expertise, because the analysts don't have the investigative skills of the police. The police certainly don't have the analytical skills of the agency. And the consequence is, if you're not careful, you get groupthink. You get people in the agencies counterintuitively, maybe not being suspicious enough. Maybe it's just they get so much of this stuff across their screens every day that they can become almost, I won't say blasé, but almost too accustomed to it. And you need someone there who's been on the street who can say, well, you know, I think this needs a further look. So one big lesson that came out of this exercise about working together is that when the triage is performed, there have to be more cases in which you get both police and MI5 performing that triage. But I think another lesson that came out, and this was the really difficult one, and I think the really countercultural one for the intelligence agencies to stomach, they've got to share the fruits of their intelligence a little more widely. And I'm sure it's the same all over the world, that intelligence agencies like to keep the secret stuff for themselves. And of course, there are all kinds of difficulties, source protection and so on, if you're going to feed it out more widely. But I think the moral we took from the attacks that got through, and incidentally, there are, you know, a small minority of the attempted attacks that we've had over the last 12 months, is that local policing, local agencies just didn't know enough. And if the intelligence world is prepared to share with them just a little more, even if it's only in terms of, you know, which gang members they should be keeping an eye on from a different perspective, then they are going to get more back to inform their strategic objectives. I think that was a difficult conclusion for MI5 to come to, but they have come to it, and we're going to see in the year ahead whether they're prepared to implement what I think are very fine intentions.
So based on what you just said, and sort of at first blush from my perspective, that this seems like a very useful function for someone to serve, perhaps on an ongoing basis. But I know that you've reflected that this model isn't necessarily ideal for every situation. And so what about this particular inflection point made MI5 or the police more receptive or less receptive to your probing and to your presence?
I think it worked this time because everybody on this island was shocked by what happened in the spring and summer of last year. You know, we had 36 deaths in total from four attacks, three by Islamists, one by an extreme right winger. And I don't think people were exactly complacent. But for 2 years, we'd seen things going off all over Europe. We'd seen appalling carnage in France, in Belgium, in Germany, Denmark, in Sweden. And there was a kind of sense that we were different and our intelligence was better and we could probably handle things. Because, of course, the threat here, everyone has always acknowledged, is huge. You know, we have 3,000 people under active investigation by MI5, under active investigation for Islamist terrorism. We have another 20,000 former subjects of interest, some of whom history shows may easily re-engage. So the scale of the problem is huge. We've done extraordinarily well. And I think it was the fact that people were so shocked that actually made them open to the idea of significant change. That's why this experiment, you know, it worked well on this occasion. I think it worked well also because both MI5 and CT Policing are basically, at the moment, very sound organizations. They're well led, they're highly ethical, they're committed to the rule of law, and that means that, certainly my experience was, they did not engage in the exercise of digging defensive redoubts, putting up smoke screens, trying to put me off the scent. They were sincere about trying to learn lessons. In fact, it was almost, you know, comforting for them, I suspect, to be able to say at the end of the day, right, here are 130 things we've agreed to do. It's so difficult looking at these threats every day, trying to make fine judgments about which need investigation and which you can afford to leave. It's reassuring for them to feel, having slipped up on two or three occasions, we can do better next time, and these changes are going to help us do it.
And as I understand it, the experiment isn't quite over yet. Is it right that you'll be playing some sort of supervisory mechanism over the next couple of years or assessing the implementation of the recommendations? What does your involvement look like in the future?
Well, I've still to discuss that in detail, but I think in essence I'll go back every two or three months. I will expect a formal presentation on how each one of the recommendations is being implemented. I'll talk to the relevant people, including the relevant people on the ground, and I'll report to the Home Secretary. There is a parliamentary committee, the equivalent perhaps of your Senate Intelligence Committee, which will be in fact doing a similar kind of job, and I have to speak to them to decide how we do that work between us. But it's a 12-month assignment, and the idea is that by the end of that 12 months, the changes will all have been implemented.
So I'm interested I've been interested in this question for a long time, whether and to what extent the institution of the special reviewer or this embed incarnation version of it is an exportable institution to the United States. So we have congressional oversight. We have lots of inspectors general and internal oversight mechanisms. And we have the PCLOB, none of which has sort of the prestige of the offices that the roles that you played. And I'm just interested for your thoughts. Is this a function of sort of the American separation of powers model that makes this stuff necessarily a little bit more adversarial? Or is it just that this is a tradition that developed kind of organically in Britain and has worked there? And you actually could, if Admiral Rogers wanted to call somebody up and say, hey, I'll clear you to sit in on everything and make recommendations, that's actually something that, you know, institutions in the United States could reasonably think about doing.
Well, I think in the US, as in the UK, you are quite pragmatic about these things, and you are not afraid to look at solutions that work, whether they're sort of classically traditional or not. The function has been exported more or less in identical form to Australia, where they've had the job for 6 or 7 years now, where it's currently in very good hands, as it is indeed in the hands of my successor in the UK, Max Hill QC. And there are not dissimilar functions in France and in the Netherlands. I think, as you say, perhaps the closest in the US is the PCLOB. But I think the success of it is partly exactly in this flexibility. Of course, like you, we have legislative committees that oversee intelligence and that look at counterterrorism law and practice in all its manifestations. But something then comes up that might be quite urgent. For example, we had, you will remember, Ben, some years ago now, we had the Binyam Mohamed case in the UK, case about what we call the control principle, are the circumstances in which evidence supplied by the US could come out in court proceedings in the UK. And there was an enormous diplomatic fuss about it after a court in England said that it wasn't sure it believed what Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, had said in a sworn affidavit. Americans were expressing strong views about it. And I was asked actually by a parliamentary committee that does not have security clearance, but that was looking at this from the aspect of civil justice. You know, do you think the Americans are really as upset as people are claiming? Because somebody had contacts in the FBI who said, well, it's a lot of fuss about nothing. So I basically went there. I think it's the first time I met you actually, Ben. I mean, I came over to DC and, you know, I spoke to a lot of people. I spoke to people in the Congress. I spoke to Harold Coe. I spoke to people in the Attorney General's Department of Justice, and indeed the State Department. And I was able to come back and give them, and indeed, of course, in the CIA and the intelligence community more widely. So in a way, as the trusted interlocutor of Parliament, that gave me the status to come back and say, actually, they really are upset, and the following people are most upset, and this, I think, is why, and this is what you're going to need to put in this bill if it's going to be acceptable in the US. And the parliamentary committee then publishes its report. It reproduces my advice. So in a way, that was filling a gap that couldn't easily have been filled without somebody like me on hand.
So for listeners who don't remember that episode, this was a very significant flap in less in U.S.-British relations than in the judicial elements of U.S.-British relations. And it was part of the whole detention, interrogation, fallout, friction that happened in the years post 9/11, and that had a very, very long tail in British courts.
That's exactly right. It culminated in an Act of Parliament, which introduces what we call closed material procedures, which is a mechanism in ordinary civil cases involving intelligence for the court effectively to go into closed session with the interests of the subject who is not privy to secret information being represented by a special advocate who sees everything but cannot speak to his or her client after the case has gone into closed. Very, very controversial legislation. And it was in the context of that, really, that I was, I made my visit to the US and reported back.
I will just say, at the risk of making a political, of sounding like a political statement, which I really don't mean this to be, this was actually a model of how allies and countries with justice systems that need to be able to harmonize with each other and with the intelligence apparatuses and operations of both get to a acceptable working set of understandings over a long period of time. And it is precisely the sort of interactions that are much harder today when you don't have necessarily very solid leadership that is sort of capable of being sober. It's very hard to imagine how this sort of thing would develop the way it did 10 years ago or 8 years ago currently.
So I'd actually like to ask you that question. Do you have a perspective on the relationship between the UK and the US today, insofar as there have been sort of outward or public political characterizations of it, but has that affected intelligence cooperation or the intelligence community in the UK?
Well, I was last over in the US a few months ago. I went to speak to the lawyers of the US intelligence community. It's an annual conference they have in Virginia. And I don't think it was just for me. I mean, I was struck, as I always am, by the enormous and really genuine warmth that there is there, and also the professional respect for the work that the Brits do. I mean, our intelligence budget is tiny compared to yours. I think it's no more than about $4.5 billion. But everyone here is extremely conscious that the Five Eyes is not an arrangement based on sentiment. It's based on performance. And we need to bring things to the party just as the other members of the Five Eyes do. And I see a great deal of mutual respect between intelligence professionals and indeed between leaders and politicians who know about intelligence and engage in intelligence. Brits are well known to have an obsession with this slightly strange phrase, a special relationship, which they use in relation to US and UK. And it's often said the special relationship is dead. I'm quite sure that there is a special relationship when it comes to intelligence, and long may it last.
That was extremely diplomatic of you.
No, I mean it. I mean it. I wasn't trying to be diplomatic. Obviously there are, there are sensitivities, this whole question of leaking is one. I think that there have been occasions in each of our countries where people have got extremely worked up about the possibility that undesirable leaks may be taking place. And I mentioned the example of the British courts, which were supposed, I think, actually unfairly to be minded to publicise classified information. In fact, it had already been placed in the public domain in the US. But similarly, we had, during the attacks of last year, there was intelligence conveyed secretly to Washington, which found its way with indecent haste onto the front page of the US press. But I think it's a gauge of the strength of the bilateral relationship that these things are no more than irritants. I mean, nobody would dream of suggesting that as a consequence of this, the relationship should be seriously downgraded. I think the interaction, the interoperability is just too strong, particularly between GCHQ and the NSA. I mean, you go into GCHQ, you see a lot of people with NSA lanyards, and I'm sure the same is true the other way around. These are operations that each knows how the other functions, and they function at their best, I think, when they're functioning together.
Turning to the other side of the UK geographically, I know that you've written a little bit about how Brexit might jeopardize or certainly will jeopardize the UK's leadership for a little bit of time in intelligence policy in the region. Could you reflect a little bit on how the UK might want to address that during Brexit negotiations?
Okay, well, it looks like the UK is going to leave the European Union. That's perhaps not yet entirely final, but that's certainly the intention. First point I'd make is the European Union is not an intelligence union. And if you talk, indeed, as I was talking this morning, to intelligence officials from other member states, their determination is that Brexit should not affect the intelligence relationship. I mean, why would they want it to? They are probably, on balance, net recipients of intelligence from the likes of GCHQ and MI6. And indeed, what we've seen in the last few months is the construction of a group called the Counterterrorism Group, which puts together a number of European countries' intelligence agencies to share more effectively intelligence on. There may be difficulties at the level of policing when it comes, for example, to access to databases, PNR records, passenger name records, financial data that are generated in other countries and that UK policing might want to see. We're going to find ourselves very much in the position that the US have been in with Safe Harbor, Privacy Shield, and indeed the Canadians. Both those North American countries have had difficulties with the European institutions, particularly the European Court, in persuading them that their systems for safeguarding personal data are up to standards that Europe considers acceptable. And we no doubt also are going to need an adequacy agreement of some kind from the European Commission, which the European Court approves, if we are going to be able to continue sharing this absolutely vital data. And if you think, for example, of the people returning from Syria and Iraq to the UK, many of them taking direct routes through a wide range of European countries, we've become used to a pretty effective system of information sharing. And without that, I think we'd be very much worse off than we are at the moment. So there's a lot of negotiation to be done on that. The European Union is a fairly legalistic institution. If you pull out, you are a third country. There's no presumption that you will be allowed to carry on participating simply because it makes sense to everybody. You're going to have to construct some new treaty, some new arrangement that allows us to emulate as much as we can the advantages of what we had before. The sadness, from my point of view, is that we've been the leaders, I would say, in counterterrorism in Europe. We've been behind most of the big initiatives of the last 15 years, and we're going to obviously surrender that leadership role when we come out. We'll be taking other people's rules rather than helping to make rules for the whole continent.
So the idea of taking other people's rules is particularly fascinating, especially because you, and I think you're a great person to comment on this, over your period have in fact shaped UK domestic intelligence policy. So at least one of your papers, if I understand correctly, is cited as the blueprint for the Investigatory Powers Act. And that, of course, has fomented quite a bit of discussion around whether or not it would meet, let's say, the standards for an adequacy decision with the EU. You've spoken favorably about the IPA insofar as it promotes transparency, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the UK's domestic legislation insofar as it may or may not conflict with EU expectations.
Yeah, well, I had a terrific blank canvas in 2014. I was asked to report on the exercise of investigatory powers across the board by intelligence agencies, by police, and by others. And my conclusion was that the existing law was not fit for purpose. It was opaque. A member of the public, a legislator even, could not be aware from looking at the law and the published guidance on the law what powers were actually being used. And whatever you think of Edward Snowden, in my case, it's not very much. I think one has to accept that the consequence of what he revealed was to force the realization, if you like, that people had to be a lot more transparent. And to me, this was a rule of law issue, and it was something that that had to be put right. So the main characteristics of our new law, first of all, they do have, the law has in it extensive powers, including powers relating to the bulk collection of data, similar, for example, to your section 702. There's a power not dissimilar to your section 215, although I think it was it's a much more useful power as it exists in the UK and as it's used in the UK. But with those strong powers comes much more transparency. I think probably world-leading transparency. CNE, for example, computer network exploitation or equipment interference, as we now call it. The existence of the power, the limits on the power, disclosed, dealt with exhaustively in the law, in guidance that accompanied the law. This is a capability that until 2015 was completely secret in the UK. Nobody knew about it at all. So to me, that was, in a sense, undemocratic. So much more transparency and also much stronger safeguards. So we had piecemeal oversight of our intelligence agencies and police insofar as they exercise similar powers. They've been replaced by one really super regulator governed by judges, which will not only perform oversight functions, but which will also grant approval of intrusive warrants. In a way, this is our church committee moment, our McDonald Commission moment, thinking of the Canadian example, where we finally accept that you cannot have government ministers authorizing these intrusive measures without the check that is imposed by an independent judiciary. So it was a fairly revolutionary law. I think it commanded a sufficient political consensus in the UK because the civil liberties people, the NGOs, really appreciated the extra safeguards. Mm-hmm. And the intelligence community was very, very grateful to hang on to powers which had been very controversial, but which they undoubtedly find very useful in keeping us safe.
And since then, I'm glad you sort of touched on technology, because since the development of the IPA, there have been, I think, revelations or technological advancements that have sort of taken some of the surveillance and intelligence collection out of the hands of government and into private companies. And so you've spoken a little bit about developing the government's relationship with intermediaries, social media companies, insofar as tackling extremist material online is concerned. And how do you see that relationship developing in the UK?
This is huge. I mean, this is the, I think, the big legislative debate of the next 10 years. You go back to 1996 and the Declaration of Digital Independence. Do you remember the governments of the world described as weary giants of flesh and steel who have no place online, no place in cyberspace? Mm-hmm. And I think what we are seeing now played out in all countries of the world is this great question of is the internet different? Do these companies have the right to operate with freedom and impunity, or must they be shackled and trammeled in the same way as broadcasters are in Europe, or even subject to some of the same obligations as printed media? It's an absolutely huge question, and it's played out in so many different situations. Of course, where you've seen regulation moving quickest, certainly in Europe, has been in the field of intellectual property. Mm-hmm. So you've had a lot of cases brought years ago now by people who find, for example, French perfume manufacturers. They find that counterfeit versions of their goods are being advertised on eBay. So they sue eBay and they say, you know, you're not a platform, you're a publisher. You have to take responsibility for these illegal products, and we can sue you for trademark infringement. The courts say yes, and eBay mends its ways. What's coming along behind, because there's not so much money in it, is child sexual exploitation. Mm-hmm. It's terrorism. It's saying to Google, you know, it's not good enough. I search for the Islamic State magazine, and on the first page, I get instructions how to deploy my knife, how to drive my truck, mm-hmm. So as to kill a maximum number of people. YouTube, all the rest of it. And I think there, what everyone is doing in Europe is looking at the German model, where they've got this, if I can pronounce it, Durchsetzungsnetzgesetz.
Much better than I can do.
Just coming into force, but potentially imposing penalties of up to 50 million euros on companies that persistently refuse to take down material that violates or obviously violates German hate speech laws. Now, nowhere else in Europe has gone that far. Certainly in the UK, we're still at the stage of working with Google, working with Facebook, working with Twitter. But you know, at the moment, they're making improvements, but are they going fast enough? Is there more they could do? And what about all the other companies that maybe aren't as socially responsible as those ones? Are we going to have to move into this world of effectively regulating content? I think what we're seeing is a huge conflict between, you know, maybe Californian libertarian-influenced free speech ideas on the one hand, and European ideas of, you know, if it moves, regulate it. I mean, exaggerating probably both ends of that spectrum. But it's going to be a fascinating 5 or 10 years, and I think we are going to see more regulation in Europe. But for myself, I hope the social media companies are able to move fast enough to fend off the worst of it. Because we don't want to strangle the extraordinary innovations these companies are capable of. And we certainly don't want to strangle free speech.
Absolutely. And that tension I've seen sort of inherent to a lot of the work that you've done over the course of your time in the UK. There are policies like the Prevent policy, which is constantly balancing that, I'd imagine. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably where I tangled most with the government. I mean, for the best of reasons, they want to protect people from being drawn into terrorism. And the concept of, you know, CVE, combating violent extremism, is well known in the US. But, you know, their idea was to go further still and let's combat the nonviolent stuff as well. And let's have a counter-extremism policy. Well, you know, I think that's fine if that means you send people into schools to tell them about, tolerance and diversity and so on. But when it becomes imposing penalties on people for the expression of non-violent opinions, then I think it gets very doubtful indeed. So that was an area where, as independent reviewer, I spent obviously quite a lot of time with Muslims, just as I spent time with communities in Northern Ireland. And one of the things the job enabled me to do was to talk to Muslims that maybe the government didn't feel it could, not because they were necessarily terrorists, although of course I spoke to terrorists too, but because their views on this, that, or the other were considered beyond the pale by government. And I was able to some extent to feed that back to people who didn't feel they could have those conversations themselves and maybe put up the odd red flag and say, if you're going to go here, you've got to be really careful, because there's a risk that what you're proposing is going to be counterproductive.
So I'm sorry that we were only able to talk about a portion of your career. You have, as an attorney, an incredible breadth of experience. And so it's a pleasure to speak to you, even about just a fraction of the time that you've spent in the law and in government. I noticed on your website that you gave a talk entitled Lawyering in the Age of Trump. And I wonder if you, I mean, this is obviously a huge part of the conversation amongst lawyers here in the States, but I'm curious about the UK perspective. I'm wondering if you could reflect on how this affects UK legal practice.
Oh, well, this was actually an address I gave at a legal service in a cathedral in England. So I gave them a bit of Isaiah, who tells you what terrible things happen to leaders who tell lies. I mean, they basically get trampled into the dust and run over by chariots. And I thought that was pretty satisfying stuff. And I gave them a bit of the New Testament about how terrible lawyers are. And, you know, they're very concerned about getting their tithe on the cumin and the peppercorns, but a bit less concerned with justice. And I think what I was really saying, and I don't think I was, you know, particularly aiming it at President Trump, but I was saying it's really alarming for democracy if not the politicians lie. I mean, we're all used to politicians lying, but we're also used to them generally facing consequences when they're found out. And what seemed to me at the time, and this is almost a year ago now, in the early weeks of the Trump administration, is that someone who seemed to have a disregard for whether something was true or false could just be very corrosive of the values that we stand for. I mean, I'm conscious this is not perhaps an uncommon position, but it seems to me that where shocking things happen, we need not to lose our ability to be shocked. And that's, I think, really what I was saying. And I was saying that the law, much maligned by the New Testament and many others, but if it's good at one thing, it is weighing evidence with minute care and drawing conclusions from it. And I took the example from the apartheid years in South Africa, and then subsequent years also, in which it was sought to ban the provision of medicines for people who are HIV positive on the basis that HIV wasn't a real disease. I was able to use the example of what the law courts did in that case in order to demolish political bigotry by the light of reason and logical argument. And I said, well, there are lots of things lawyers are not very good at, but that's one thing we're very good at, and we mustn't be afraid of doing it, because that is an absolutely essential part of preserving our democracy against the many things that threaten it just now.
Well, you've certainly exemplified those values over the course of your career. It has been a pleasure to speak with you. David, thank you for your time today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave us with? I'm not sure if you want to get on the recording a closing statement or anything that you didn't mention today that you'd like to be in the podcast.
I just say thank you to the Lawfare blog. I've read it most days that I've been doing this job. I'm grateful to those who put it together and for those who fund it. Long may it flourish.
Thank you, David.
My pleasure.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare podcast, share it on Facebook, talk about it with your friends during afternoon tea, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.